Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Well, howdy, neighbor. Come on up. Sit on the porch a spell. It's a wonderful day where we're coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia on Sunday, April the 20th, 2014. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and today's show comes to you live on Sunday beginning at 2 p.m. Central Time, and it's a two-hour show that will be replayed on Tuesday beginning at midnight and will last for 2 hours with a live chat over at Netroots Radio. We are proud to be a part of the Coffee Party Radio Network, and the Coffee Party is our host, and we are very pleased and excited about that, and we hope that you are too. You'll find me pretty much anywhere you look around the internet. All right, at the Nation Magazine, and sometimes other magazines as well. I write a blog at Daily Coast, where we experience the ongoing machinations of determining what it means to be bigger and better, more Democrat. This show is called Progressive Politics because those are the types of politics that we like. And we try to do it with style. We call Tennessee style, which means that we're genteel and we're respectful of our callers so long as they're genteel and respectful of us. We have two rules on this show. The first one is play nice. Remember that you're a guest in my house. And if you act like it, I'll give you all the respect that I can. The other one is come prepared. If you want to give us your opinion about one thing or another, please feel free to do so. I put a big box around it and say, this is my opinion or in my view, or let us know that you're telling us how you feel about it and let it rip. We'll listen to you. I may respond to you with some questions. Not necessarily because I agree or disagree with you, but because I want to get some sense of understanding how much you thought this out. And if you're using factual-based events and activities and dates and people and things, We believe that it's possible to have civil discourse between disagreeing views. This radio show is one of several that try to do that each and every week. We appreciate civility, and we believe that if we can once again begin talking to one another, we might be able to come up with some positive solutions for the things that are wrong in our country today, or things that people think are wrong in our country today, and make a difference marching forward. And that's what this show is all about. It highlights the activities, the activists, and the activism of progressives across the country. And we hope that you enjoy the show. We have people that are with us virtually every week. And we very much like talking to you about things that we believe matter in the real world. We have a blog over at coffeepartyusa.com where myself and others blog on a regular basis. You can follow us on Facebook where we have regular entries over there. And you might be interested in knowing that we have issues on our blog that are specific to us. That is to say, the things that we feel directly impact or reflect the issues that we as a coffee party have, that we would like to get in front of the legislatures and federal officers and stuff like that. When we talk about civility, we have, for the members of the coffee party, we have a pledge that we ask them to sign. It's not necessary, but we ask you to. And it says, as a member or supporter of the coffee party, I pledge to conduct myself in a way that is civil, honest, and respectful toward people with whom I disagree. I value people from different cultures. I value people with different ideas. And I value and cherish the democratic process. That's the civility pledge. And I agree with it. That's one of the reasons why I became a member of the Coffee Party. I am a Democrat by registration. I am a progressive by action. And I am a member of the Coffee Party on purpose. And that's one of the ways that we differentiate ourselves from other activities that you might find around the internet in what's generally referred to as the political world. Our mission statement says that we are building, nurturing, and connecting communities to reclaim our government for the people. We envision a nation of diverse communities sharing a culture of informed public engagement where our sacred right to vote is the only currency of our democracy. We have some core values, and that is that we live the values we want to see in our government, which includes civility, where we empathize and engage with one another, exercising humility, listening, honesty, and respect in order to provide an emotionally safe environment even when we disagree. Another core value is that of continuous learning. In the coffee party, we seek the truth, learn the facts, and share with others to make informed decisions relevant to the ongoing improvement of ourselves, our nation, and our shared, overlapping lives. Another core value is authenticity and transparency. Because we are human, in our genuine quest for democracy, we may stumble, but we do so in plain sight, with trust and expecting a hand up from one another. Core value is integrity and clarity. What we say is what we mean. We do what we say. And in so doing, we strive to create a country that is whole and undiminished. A core value is inclusiveness. We reach out, engage, and connect with people from diverse communities, backgrounds, cultures, and political perspectives. We believe in transpartisanship and independence, which means that we engage in political and social bridge building for the sake of finding solutions to common problems, working above and beyond ideological dogmas, putting the country as citizen first. Now, on the face of it, that sounds like it's not so much, but if you look at it and think about it sincerely for a few minutes, you might find that's a whale of a statement. But that's what the coffee party is working about. That's what we do. And you can join us. You can become a member, a volunteer. You can help recruit membership. We've got well over 500,000 members. You can be a part of a local group. It's not a problem. We believe that corporations are not people. We believe that money is not equal to speech. And we believe that every citizen is entitled to an equal vote. But no citizen is entitled to an unequal vote. We want to create an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which will overturn Citizens United and necessarily by it, McCutcheon versus FEC. That says basically that very thing. Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. One man, one vote. We have position papers on several of the things that we care about, including corporate welfare, tax breaks and budget cuts, corporate tax dodgers, Citizens United, and military spending, because these reflect the primary concerns of a majority of our membership. We do not have a platform. We have issues that we try to address as a grassroots organization, and starting with two, now we're over 500,000, 553,000. The Coffee Party intends to spread our message of civility, respect, and honorable discourse across the land. We're on the radio several days a week through the radio network. We're on Sundays, Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. We also have podcasts available for any time listening. We archive every episode of this show as well. And we are involved in activities and grassroots organizing. We have newsletters and all kinds of communication devices from our blog to our radio show, which is what we hope you will do with us here. And today I want to talk about some things that are going on around us. First of all, if you are a Christian in the West, I want to wish you a very happy and blessed Easter. And I hope that by now you've had your Easter celebration and the Easter eggs have been found and the baskets have been passed out and the food has been eaten. And if you would like to tell us about your celebration, you can give us a call at area code 646-929-2495. You can also join us in our chat room where Progressive Patty and her team are helping all our visitors in the chat room with comments. And if you have a question for us in the chat room, guests, please just type it in. And we will respond to it as we can on air. And if you'd like to call us and let us know if you have any ideas, that'll be fine too. We have some regular visitors to this show that we appreciate, so I'd like to give them a shout out and say that I hope you have a happy Easter and because some of those folks are in different areas of the world. They'll be watching America's Easter celebration with interest. A couple of things are kind of warmed up, ready to be served up, and we'll talk about those. We'll talk about some of the stuff going on around the country. It's getting to be campaign season for 2014. And there's a lot of interest in the amount of money that's being spent already. Who's spending it and why? We'll talk about the Affordable Care Act a little bit and get your views on the fact that now we've got some final numbers for the deadline sign-ups that push us well over 8 million Americans, and we will talk about the 7 million Americans that could but are not allowed to sign up for it because of their state. We'll talk about Ukraine. We'll talk about the emerging views of Russian President Putin and what seems to be developing as his view for his country. And we'll talk a little bit about people who seem to think that they have the right to supersede the laws of this land and talk about the effects of those things. It's going to be a laid-back show, not with strict enforcement of an agenda. So it's a good time for you to call if there's something special you'd like to talk about. Call us at 646-929-2495. Please remember our two rules, and we will discuss it with you on the air. I'd like to start with the notion that we are an American nation. And as citizens of that nation, we all have an obligation, responsibility matched with our privilege and our blessing. According to some of the media, this past week has been a quote, the unholy war on Easter. I'm afraid that that is a mindset only of a very small minority of Americans. While you let that bake in your brain, understand that sometimes we have agreements and disagreements based upon things that are genuinely and passionately felt. And this show has given me a proof that I have to live with every day, which says that you can be absolutely sincere and passionate in your belief about a thing and still have that belief be absolutely wrong. As there is no attack on Christmas, there's no attack on Easter. Not there. Now, there are those over at Fox News that would love to twist that and spin it into a situation that they can then run up. The trouble is, when Fox does that, they have a very bad habit of getting passionately involved in mistruth, falsehood, and purposeful prevarication, because they love to see people up in arms about one thing or another. And if it has to do with conservative side of politics, they're there. They're the ones that are you need to go to, because you know, it is Fox that warns of this unholy war on Easter. And there's an article that I read that says that the number of things that set decent God-fearing folks off really easy does seem infinite. Chief among them is daring to even express an opinion other than their own, because that's opposing them, you see. In a lead that said the new unholy war on Easter, finding a new battleground in the Windy City, kind of got our attention, so we asked them to please proceed. The Freedom From Religious Foundation, an atheist group, no they're not, that allegedly already posted an anti-Easter sign in the Wisconsin state capitol, is now erecting a massive display in Chicago's Daily Plaza. The massive display consists of 2 8-foot banners featuring Thomas Jefferson and President John Adams promoting the secular views of our founding fathers. Well, one banner reads, "In Reason We Trust." The other will say, "Keep State and Religion Separate." The exhibit, aimed at countering the Jesus in Daily Plaza, displaying a display that is going on today or going up today. It's been going on for 8 years. It kind of takes away some of the impetus to the speed of what they're doing now. It features a 19-foot tall cross and a 10-foot tall image of the resurrected Jesus. Has Easter evolved into an occasion to demean religious beliefs in Christianity? We talk about Satan. Our view is, since it's been going on 8 years, it's clear our national tradition, and how dare some other group try to bring the Hellhound Founding Fathers into this. Well, everybody agrees that it's within the atheist's rights to put up their own public display, even if it lacks, quote, class. What we can't agree on, what we cannot agree on, is whether merely expressing an opinion other than a belief in Christianity in the public square is an unholy attack on Christianity. Fox News says it is. Founding Fathers didn't seem to think so. And I guess the Founding Fathers don't have their own television network, so, you know, sucks to be them. We have been a multicultural reality since before our founding. There was a lot of religiousness, or religiosity, if you will, involved in this nation from the time of the first founding to the time of the first settlers from Europe who came over and with the love of Christ and their fellow man began giving the left foot of fellowship to the inhabitants herein. And decided that coexistence was not going to work for very long as they eyed themselves to the west. And once they could figure out how to survive here, which took, by the way, several tries, banned. It wasn't so much a predetermined outcome as it was a happy instance that they found out they could, where they'd been in cities in Europe and Northern Europe and Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, Western Europe and the British Isles. That was pretty compacted. Several tens of people per square block or mile. There wasn't no room to breathe. All over here there was. And it seemed to go on forever. And all they had to do was deal with the people who were living there at the time. It's no big deal. And from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico, we saw that people were coming here at potentially what could be called alarming rates. We know that there came a time when there was a celebration of the harvest because the local natives had taught the colonists, the strangers in their land, with their own crop, by the way, how to create sustainable food. It wasn't exactly to the taste of the colonists. Yet starvation and death had been a rather high statistic in the exploration of the Eastern Seaboard. And they well, there was an issue before that they were able to solve rather quickly and simply. The people who were living here at the time the colonists existed or came over were willing to live and let live and give them some space to try and figure it all out. And there were pockets up and down the seaboard as time went on. If you look through the early 1600s into the 1700s, where we went from border to border and we claimed it as our own, and we didn't ask permission, we just took it. Wars developed. We weren't going anywhere. That today remains one of the great unaddressed sins of America. And I think it's okay that we talk about that on Easter, because Easter is about forgiveness and reparation and how to move forward from past wrongs. And every time you ask somebody about this, whoever it is you ask, depending on who they are, has an opinion. But it's not very often that those who have opinions that are diverse or diversely different get connected on the same wavelength and talk about it. You might imagine that to be a rather interesting conversation that might be rather passionate and energy filled. Yeah, I would agree with you. And we always offer our air for anyone who would like to come on and discuss and work toward a feasible solution to any problem. Well, there's no problem too big. And because it's Easter, we feel like we can have the promise of agreement and resolution and hope. So, number 646-929-2495. Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is something that Americans have been discussing for several years. It is designed to be a program whereby it is feasibly possible, not feasibly impossible, for every American citizen to have affordable, usable health care, that they never need to feel other, that they can go to a hospital or a doctor and feel the respect of a patient who is in a constant agreement contractually with their doctor, instead of having to feel undeserving, unqualified, unworthy, and unable to pay. It's very interesting that program has been the focus of a political party who for several and sundry reasons has decided that it is a bad thing. It started, interestingly enough, as the baby of said same party. But when a Democratic leader said, okay, let's do that, all of a sudden their idea got to be ugly. They had helped create it. And because this president dared to put it forward in his first year in office with, you know, communication between he and his party and the party opposite others, they had decided that they were going to obstruct the legitimate winner of the election and show them how elections didn't matter, that it was their way or the highway. And this president, unfortunately, was one who saw things a different way. And because of that, his continuation to attempt to be engaging and to engage those of other political ilk to come together to make a common agreement about the necessary for health care coverage for all Americans, got some rancor going. And as we well remember, there was a time when the Republicans and conservatives of this land simply walked out of the possibility and said, we're not doing it because we're not going to do it as long as he's here anyway, which gave a lot of folks cause for pause, looking and saying, is it us or is it just him? And a lot of folks said, well, it's just him. A lot of folks said, it has nothing to do with him. It has to do with what he's proposing. We don't believe that's appropriate for America. And we never got to the point where that was a conversation we could have because of the rancor and the disfellowship which came from it. And so the United States Congress, in one of its weaker moments, passed one of the most significant pieces of legislation in the history of this land that was known as the PPACA, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And there have been no less than 100 attempts by the Republicans, sometimes with a modicum of Democratic support, to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And the Affordable Care Act had a very bad rollout. We thought that it would go one way, and it wound up going another. And we had until the end of March to, you know, get as many people as we felt could justify using the marketplace, which is not merely an illusion of competition, but actually the place of competition for health care provision in America. In other words, it's not that people's right to choose private health care was taken away. It was that all the health care agency providers were put in a common place so that anybody could look at what they had. And there were a lot of people who were rather unceremoniously suddenly kicked off their health insurance plans. And I don't know how people decided that that was President Obama's fault, but a lot of folks did. Disregarding the fact that it hadn't come from Washington, D.C., it came from their health insurance companies. So we did a little investigation and found out that what people were losing were policies that were the health insurance agency providers required to address specifically. They would first have to agree that they were selling non-insurance insurance products, which meant that they were selling plans to people that had no benefits whatsoever. And these were, for the most part, A, much cheaper plans. B, plans that tended to be available to those who couldn't hit the high mark of qualification for most insurance carriers because of a pre-existing condition or because of being a pregnant female who'd been pregnant before or some other completely illusionary causation. There are also plans that were included in a review system that is completely immoral and unethical, and in every case where it's been tried, also illegal. And that's called, they're put into the plan where they only underwrite your policy, which means to qualify, to check to see if you're qualified to own a policy if you file a claim. Otherwise, they just take your payments. The trouble with this is that at time of claim, when they underwrite at time of claim, the very first thing that historically happens is that your claim is denied. Then you have to go through a dog and pony show to either get to the point where it is accepted or you come to learn they never intended to cover that claim or any other claim on your policy in the first place. They were just collecting premiums for a piece of paper. There was no insurance involved. It's called junk insurance. It's widely known in the industry, and it's been one of the biggest dangers to the industry since Mr. Franklin thought up the idea of fire insurance. But now, after March 30th or 31st, you know, there was a big push to get the system on track, and we heard a lot about that. We heard a lot about death panels, and we heard about the death spiral, and we heard about all that, and high dollars were spent. Your dollars were spent well more than 100 times at the federal level by a couple of people who were deciding that they were going to get rid of this president by getting rid of what they considered to be his landmark legislation, which they called Obamacare. Trouble was, in 6 months, 8 million Americans went through the mill with the final outcome that they not only had insurance that was legitimate, but was insurance that they could afford. Now, it should be said that this is a federal program. It's not a state program. And there are a number of states that have decided that they're going to be so recalcitrant and so anti this president that they're going to deny their own citizens the right and the ability to participate in the marketplace. Now, there's a report out today by a writer by the name of John Pear who talks about the epidemic of GOP virus that will kill thousands in red states. And what he's talking about is the difference between the pre-ACA uninsured and the post-ACA uninsured, the number that could have been insured by Medicaid opt-in if the state had chosen to do so, and the high and low estimates of citizens' deaths that will occur primarily because they are not able to receive the health care that they need. The cost of opting out of Medicaid expansion, and this comes from a study that was done by the Health and Financial Impact of Health Affairs Organization, Health Affairs Magazine. And the report is called Opting Out of Medicaid Expansion, the Health and Financial Impacts. And in my own state of Tennessee, for instance, there were 892,107 citizens of Tennessee that were not insured before the Affordable Care Act. Now, in Tennessee, after that, once there was a post-ACA, the uninsured level was at 744,665. The difference was there were also 310,180 Tennesseans who could have been insured had the state decided to allow the federal government to spend 10 years paying 100% of the cost of the opt-in. So we could have effectively cut the uninsured in our state by half. The high estimate for needless deaths in the next year in Tennessee are 759 and a minimum of 284 based upon pretty reliable mortality statistics. Nationally, that number, which could have been insured by Medicaid opt-in, is 7,781,829 citizens of this country. Imagine as the Centers for Disease Control warned that America was about to be hit by a preventable epidemic of a deadly, though curable, virus. In response, the federal government budgeted funds for each of the 50 states to purchase antidotes to save the afflicted and vaccines to immunize citizens against future outbreaks. Recognizing the gravity of the situation, the White House raises the revenue to completely cover the costs of the emergency program for 3 years and promises to pay 90% of the bill after that. Even picking up 10% of the tab, most states would come out a lot ahead by virtue of not having to pay for the care for the sick and the dying. All the 50 governors and state legislatures have to do to save thousands of their residents from needless deaths was to say one word to free money from Uncle Sam. Yes. Now imagine that 24 states simply said no, for no reason other than their leaders' dislike of the president and his political party. Does that sound inconceivable? Well, it shouldn't. It's actually happening right now. By rejecting the Affordable Care Act expansion of Medicaid, Republicans are making the unconscionable routine of the unconscionable routine by guaranteeing that thousands of their own constituents will die every year. Die, that is, from the GOP virus. That's not hyperbole, it's a reality. This is the greatest act of political spite in American history. Now, it is easy to say Republicans because these are Republican states we're talking about. Let me give you a few. Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, Louisiana, Indiana, Missouri, Alabama, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Wisconsin, Kansas, Utah, Idaho, Nebraska, Montana, New Hampshire, South Dakota, Alaska, Maine, and Wyoming. Prior to the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, studies from the Urban Institute, Families USA, and Harvard Medical School estimated the number of preventable deaths among America's 50 million uninsured at between 22,000 and 45,000 every year. As 25-plus million Americans gain coverage over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office, that unnecessary death toll would drop dramatically, not just, it turns out, in the GOP-nominated states, but those states that refuse to accept the Affordable Care Act expansion of Medicaid to millions of their currently uninsured constituents. That's the conclusion of a team of researchers from Harvard Medical School, which they recently published in Health Affairs magazine. They are the authors of the Opting Out of Medicaid Expansion, the Health and Financial Impacts Study, which we're talking about today. Quoting the study, Nationwide, 47,958,687 people were uninsured in 2012. The number of uninsured is expected to decrease by about 16 million after the implementation of the American Affordable Care Act, leaving 32,202,633 citizens uninsured. Nearly 8 million of these remaining uninsured would have gotten coverage had their state opted in. States opting into Medicaid expansion will experience a decrease of about 48.9% in their uninsured population versus an 18.1% decrease in opt-out states. Further stating the study, we estimate the number of deaths attributable to the lack of Medicaid expansion in opt-out states at between 7,115 and 17,104. Medicaid expansion in opt-out states would have resulted in 712,037 fewer persons screening positive for depression, 240,700 fewer individuals suffering catastrophic medical expenditures. Medicaid expansion in these states would have resulted in 422,553 more diabetics receiving medication for their illness. Think about that for a minute. It would have meant 195,492 more mammograms among women ages 50 to 64 years and 443,677 more pap smears among women ages 21 to 64. Expansion would have resulted in an additional 658,888 women in need of mammograms gaining insurance, as well as 3.1 million women who should receive regular pap smears. There's ongoing controversy about how often a woman should have a pap smear, but that's really not the issue in this study. The issue is how many could have had it should they have been needed. To put these findings in terms Republicans can understand, up to 3,000 of Rick Perry's Texans will needlessly die each of the next 10 years. These dead will be joined by up to 671 from Scott Walker's Wisconsin, 1,176 from Nathan Deal's Georgia, 2,221 in Rick Scott's Florida, and 1,145 in Pat McRory's North Carolina. It does therefore seem to be no wonder that Ohio GOP Governor John Kasich got biblical on Buckeye State Republicans to extend medical coverage to 300,000 of their state citizens when he said, "When you die and get to the meeting with St. Peter, he's probably not going to ask you much about what you did about keeping government small, but he's going to ask you what you did for the poor. You better have a good answer." Mercifully, it's not too late for Americans to immunize themselves. When they go to the polls in November, they can vote Democratic and kill the GOP virus dead in its tracks. And I'm going to put a link to this report, this article, into the chat room, which is one of the advantages of being in our chat room. You get to have all the direct information that we can provide. It's the only place we do it. And there's a link to the report, to the article. And inside that article are several links to the report itself from the Harvard Medical School, which the author of this story, John Pear, who is one of my writing colleagues and a very trusted source of information, has written this explanation. We believe that it's important to understand that from the Democratic progressive perspective, we had to do something to address the 30 million uninsured Americans in this country because they were no less ill or well than anybody else, but it was more difficult to get them covered because of the monopoly that insurance carriers had set up for themselves to attract profitable clients and to dismiss less than profitable or not as profitable insureds. And this comes back to the HMO days and review boards and all that sort of stuff, beyond the certificate of need boards that used to exist in the states. And all of a sudden, the health care was running medical care. And HMOs were telling doctors they had to order every test in the book, whether the patient needed it or not, because that's where the profits for the healthcare insurers came from. That changed relatively recently when the situation of the responsibility for medical care went away from the insurance carrier and went back to the doctors, which in many folks' instances was what it should have been. The relationship is between the patient and the doctor, not the doctor and the health insurer. A lot of HMOs actually bought hospitals. Some of the hospitals were bought by medical care groups, groups of doctors practicing as a group, who determined that they were going to be first in position to the patient instead of the medical carrier, the insurer. And the insurer then decided they were going to swarm the doctors with unmerciful amounts of paperwork, regulations on, you know, the $989 aspirin got kind of out of hand, so we had to create some regulations to say you have to have a reasonable expense. And patients were finding out that they were going in for a gallbladder surgery and they were being charged for a C-section. I mean, literally, the code for a C-section came up when a guy was coming out of the hospital and he saw his bill for his gallbladder operation. And they said, well, we can't have that. So we had super bundling, and then we went to deep detail, and it was found rather quickly that health insurers were just maxing out every claim they could. Because, among other things, there is a lifetime claim limit on most medical care insurance, and they'd like to reach that as soon as possible. Thank you very much. Rates continued to climb with the incidence of illness in suspect ways, suspect illnesses, suspect patients. Found out that there were patients that were billed for procedures, operations, and hospital stays that they'd never had. The billing itself became a problem because you got a bottom line bill that said, regardless of what happened to you from the hospital, not counting the doctor, the reader, the test, the labs, physical therapy, occupational therapy, moral support from the chaplain, whatever else it was, the nurses' union, to us, the hospital. You owe this much. And it doesn't mean you're not going to get more bills from these ancillary services who are unionized or coordinated in groups or anything else. It's the hospital. And all of a sudden you had multiple billings. And the doctor didn't know that the hospital charged you for his services, a service which he alone, by agreement with the hospital, he would bill you for, and all of a sudden you were paying twice for the same thing, including that $989 aspirin. And into the 90s, and it got worse. The general social contract between the health insurance provider and the patient went out the window. And it was a free-for-all where health carriers were just charging everybody everything for anything. On the one hand, they felt it was legitimate because of all the years they had been, you know, underpaid. was also a time when they were creating laboratories to develop and patent their own medicines, and that became a problem. And we're down 25% in the total amount of medical research dollars that we're expending. And the health carriers are trying to make it up because they're the ones that created the labs that are now hurting so desperately for research dollars. And it became to be so out of control that employers were starting to drop their coverage for their employees because of the expense, because every single year health premiums went up. Now, it doesn't matter if you had not claimed anything, if you weren't sick. It was just how much it was going to cost you this year to stay on the plan. Now, more and more people, because of the meltdown, financial meltdown, the economic meltdown, the housing meltdown, and the job meltdown, found themselves to be uninsured. It wasn't because they had done something wrong. It wasn't because they had not clipped their claims paid. It was nothing about not keeping their premiums paid. It was they were out of work. They had no place to live. And all of a sudden, health insurance for the family, in almost every case, became an unnecessary luxury, which meant that more and more people were out of the pool of common consent and into the pool of one and done, which meant that it would only take one hospitalization to completely bankrupt a family. That doesn't count the families who had ongoing, existing, serious medical issues at the time. Adults with debilitating diseases, the ongoing costs of getting old in America, young kids that were being, you know, determined to have serious lifelong problems, and the ongoing everyday ambulance arrivals from the intersection and the hospice. And it threatened, on top of a mortgage meltdown, a financial meltdown, there could be a healthcare meltdown. All of these things combined in 2009, the recently elected president of the United States, or president-elect, actually, he wasn't even president yet when he got his team via an emergency call from the existing president to come to Washington and try to figure out exactly what was going on. One of the things that came out of that was an idea that we have to stop the medical side of this. What was wanted was not what we got. But what we got was the first positive step forward in, at least, depending on your evaluation of it, at least 35 years. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some other things that have suddenly come up to be changes in the way America does things. And for those 8 million people who now have insurance that didn't in October of 2013, congratulations. And for those 7 million who could, I suggest you write to your governor and ask him to explain why it is that your health care is none of his concern. And ask yourself if that's the kind of representation you want. I am the Tennessee Progressive. This is Tennessee Progressive bringing you progressive politics, Tennessee style. We'll be back after the break. You all hang in there, you hear? We'll be back in a bit.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777, and it was in place until 1789. But it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force the states to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Be a man. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? You I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
Welcome back to Progressive Politics with Tennessee.
Hello, everyone. This is John.
I am still the Tennessee Progressive, and I will be coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River on this Sunday, April 20th, for 55 more minutes. And we're talking about Easter and things that are going on around America today, doing a quick roundup of all the news that's fit to use. And Easter, a time of reflection and renewal and resurrection for our Christian friends, for our Jewish friends, it's Passover. And we'd like to wish you peace and health in the coming year. Shabbat Shalom. Easter is a particularly Western institution that has been amplified to the situation where in the religious calendar, at least in Christianity, is second only to Christmas. And there are a lot of people who are celebrating Easter across the world today. And a lot of people who are celebrating Passover. And these people are, each in their own way, following their faith beliefs, as are many others, even those who profess to have no faith. And we want you to know that we believe it's entirely possible for everyone to make a difference where they live. It doesn't require you to have my faith or me to have yours. Just as it does not a requirement that you share my political ideology, or my political party, or my political views. That's not the purpose of progressive politics. Progressive politics is the idea that if we can have civil discourse and openly discuss the things that we think need to be fixed or addressed in the American political life, that we can create solutions that will do that. And we find that when we sit down in civil discourse and talk about an issue, name your issue, fill in the blank here, we generally discover two things. First of all, that we agree on about 90% of any topic raised. And the difference between now and 40 years ago is in the second thing we learn. Where 40 years ago we would look at the middle, see how far out it extended in agreement, pushed it to the limits of what was agreeable with the understanding that that much could move forward and the rest we would carve off, say for later, come back and fight another day. We don't do that anymore. What we do is we say it's my way or the highway. That tends to be a hard-nosed, all-or-nothing approach that seems to be much more preferred by the Republicans, the conservatives, ultra-conservative, TV-evangelists, and all those kind of folks that would rather see us do nothing than not get everything they want. There are some issues that that's true for Democrats as well. If you talk about we need to adjust the Social Security entitlement and adjust for inflation and tie it to the CPI, there's no way that the Democrats are going to agree to that. And the reason for that is because it is a net loss to the recipient while doing nothing to affect the cost of Medicare or Social Security or Medicaid. Generally that portion of our law which is known as the social safety net. Chaining the raises to CPI is only a loss. It takes away benefit. It takes away benefit not only for the Social Security user of the future, but has immediate impact on the Social Security user of today who, as a general rule, 99.9% of the time is dependent upon every dollar they receive through Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare to exist. So the need is there, and as passionately as I feel that the social safety net should not be touched, there are those who feel that this is an unnecessary program that is an unnecessary burden on the United States. I have difficulty with that agreement because I understand the system well enough, having not only been a part of it, but studied it for a good part of my life. You're not talking about the same system. You're not talking about what I hear is takers, and what I hear is I know that there are some cases out there where people either abuse the system or have been on the system or within the system for their whole lives. I know that. They're not a conspiracy in a majority among, you know, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid users in the United States. They are a distinct, minute minority. So are those who are so wealthy that they would never have to depend on any of these things in their lives and just do not see why they should have to be taxed on them. But this is where the word entitlement comes from. When you hear somebody talking about entitlement programs, there's a flash in there that should come across your brain. And that is that that person is talking about a program they know nothing about. An entitlement is something which is generally given in charity without expectation or realization of return. Social Security is a self-funded insurance program. You can't just walk up and apply for Social Security never having worked in this country most of the time. What you receive back from Social Security are monies with interest that you have paid for during your working life. You have to have a certain number of paychecks into Social Security before you can even qualify to try and get anything from it. One of the problems is that point right there. That is a nail you can put in the ground because there are those who say, it's my money, I deserve it, you can't take it from me. And there are those who say it was never your money and you don't get any of it. And this is the second part of that equation that I was talking about earlier, where the two sides are busy talking across purposes to each other and they're not hearing what the other one's saying and nothing gets done. How is that going to affect us in the short-term future? Well, look at what it's caused. We're not talking to each other. Now, who in their right mind would believe that it would be in the best interest of this nation, of these people, if they simply did not talk to each other? Let's see if we can find out. We've got a caller from area code 412. Caller, you're on the air with Tennessee Progressive. How can I help you today?
Hi, Bud. This is Greg from Pittsburgh.
Hi, Greg from Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing okay.
Good. I actually have a question for you. You might be able to clear something up for me when it comes to Social Security.
Okay.
I've always been under the impression that it was a social contract between the youthful working populace of the day with those who were not so fortunate of the day. In other words, the Social Security payments that I make out of my paycheck every 2 weeks or that are taken out of my paycheck every 2 weeks, it's not my money. I'm helping to fund the fact that there are people who are disabled, who are elderly, who are now getting some safety net from my dollars today. And the hope is that in the future, someday, the current population, when I'm old, will do the same for me.
Well,
do I have that wrong?
Depends on how you look at it. When the act was initiated, it was a general insurance trust fund. All of those words matter. And the first one that matters is the word general. Of all the payments that were made, a general pool would be established where all that money went. And a qualifying claimant at some point in the future would be able, specifically that individual, to go into that general pool that was created by the committed dollars of all workers who were paying Social Security tax, and to provide to that particular individual assistance or insurance in a form of cash payments that would allow them to live with dignity and respect without, you know, the amount that was given into the fund by that individual did not necessarily determine the amount they were able to pull from it. Now, generally speaking, that general trust, which meant that it was assumed that Social Security Administration would be able to accurately determine who should be able to pull from that fund at what point, for how long, and how much, was based upon their activity in the fund. Didn't always turn out that way. In fact, the very first claimant of Social Security had paid one payment of a nickel.
Right.
Okay. And they were qualified under the law as it was established at the time to legitimately make claim against Social Security and to be paid some amount of money for a very long time. The idea being that overall that would not happen. And overall it didn't. The funding source is the combined Social Security taxes that are paid by all workers and all employers at the same time to grow the fund. This happened at a time when it very quickly became realized that there was going to come a point down the road where there were going to be a lot of claimants because the population was growing.
Sure.
Overall, the entire population was younger. It was employed. It was fully employed, actually. And the fund grew at a really good clip that regardless of the number of claims that were qualified under the Social Security Act, there was still a lot more money coming into the fund than was going out. Now, in that point, that's the separation between your statement of particulars versus general disbursements. It was not the case that it was set up so that the money you put in would be available to only you.
Right.
So at that point, I think we have a slight disagreement in understanding about what the fund was. But the general fund idea, the special fund, the administrative fund, and all of that were all put into a general pool, because they felt that was the best way to do it because they were getting claims from all these different areas. And it became a point that, as it started, interestingly enough, Greg, when an employer paid an employee, both of them participated in the Social Security Fund, and the idea was, the likelihood was, that the person to claim those funds would be the employee's grandchild, because there was sufficient room in the fund for all the claimants, and the claim pool, the trust, was still growing. So there came a point at which it hopped a generation that said the money I'm putting into Social Security today is most likely going to be used by my child. In the 60s, it jumped again, and it said, well, it'll probably fund my grandchildren's retirement, because that's how effective the fund was.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Then we become a bit – we're still well ahead in the fund. The number of participants in the fund is beginning to diminish. And the reason the fund is beginning to diminish is because, as we had anticipated when the fund first started, there came the point in time where there was a very large number of people who, having worked for 30, 35, 40 years, took their Social Security claim. It became automatic at a certain age. You could opt into it at a certain age for a lesser amount. And the rules changed. But it was the most liquid fund in the United States government, and by the way, still is. But the number of claimants increased to the point where we started skipping backwards. Where we had gone from me to child to grandchild, we started skipping backwards from grandchild to child to me to who's going to pay for me.
Yeah.
That is the short story of the history of the arc of the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, we have a few things that go into that. Things which directly impact the Social Security Trust Fund have to do with employment. So as employment begins to drop, either through aging out of employment or losing of jobs to those who could pay into the fund, so that gives you a point of history that you could perhaps understand, say, the mid-70s, early 80s, NAFTA, that whole thing, that range of time. Jobs were diminishing, especially what were called accountable jobs, which meant factory work, the continuous work, as opposed to independent work or self-contract work or that sort of thing. The factory jobs were starting to be affected in the point that employers were going to their labor unions and saying, listen, we have a problem. We have to cut because of our desire to keep our profits acceptable. We have to cut operations, and we would rather do that a little across the board than shutting down an entire plant. So what we're going to ask your guys to do is to take a 15-cent pay cut for the next 3 years with the understanding that in 3 years we'll pay it back. Where there were unions, this was contested. Sometimes they had contract disputes. Sometimes they had strikes. Sometimes they had walkouts. But in a lot of cases where they were self-funded, this didn't happen. The employer had to... the statement, the employee had the decision whether or not they were going to stay there or move. This became the writing on the wall. And that didn't happen because it became a profit tactic. It happened because of the realization that the market was shrinking in America and jobs were going other places. And that's how we wound up in 2000 with 65,000 shuttered factories, one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. That had been ongoing since, say 2001. And as a simple indicator to the working population of America, the ones most directly affected by Social Security were those in the middle class. There was a point at which an administration decided, in my personal view, this is me putting a box around my opinion, did that intentionally. Because while the middle class had built out from the middle and grown to support everybody in America, it also, in the views of some, kept profit out of the hands of those who felt they were more deserving of it, not the shareholders by any means. Corporate management. And there was this very subtle shift in that social contract as well, where first we saw it in Japan and their meltdown. Then we saw it here in America. That led to our financial meltdown. where the social contract was simply abrogated by the corporations established by the state to solve a public need, which is what corporations are, how they're chartered, to the point of we started hearing things like, well, we have to increase the profit on the bottom line for our shareholders, which was a lie in every single instance. And in order to do that, we have to have fewer jobs. We have to take your 17 and a half years of experience at a very high pay rate and replace it with a non-experienced minimum wage worker so that we can add that profit back into our profit line, because that's what we expect that profit to be. And to hell with your social contract. And all of a sudden, people were losing their jobs 6 months shy of retirement. Remember the PATCO strike? Remember the loss of the first time a union trust fund was stolen? Happened to the pilots that were in the union who were flying for United Airlines.
Yeah.
Well, one day they went to work and they had 25 years plus, you know, a sizable retirement plan. By the time they landed their aircraft at the next airport, they had nothing. And they were told, suck it up, buttercup. You want to work? That's what you do. Became a standard. Where do these people go then when what they have built up has been virtually taken from them? First of all, they lose their jobs. Technically, by definition, they become unemployed. They have to file for unemployment compensation because they've been downsized at the factory while their retirement has been taken away in the skilled positions. This puts pressure on those who are not in that class, who are on the lower side in the middle class, the blue-collar worker. Because now you've got guys with master's degrees or doctoral degrees in engineering competing with college freshmen or high school graduates for hourly wage jobs. The pressure is on the middle class. The upper class is not pressured because they got what they wanted. They got the money from the retirement fund. They got the pension plans. They started busting unions, the things that were keeping them in check. They started misaddressing the needs of the people who made their success possible for the purposes of greed. Extending the beginning of rubber band around the far right edge of the equality pool, they started stretching that rubber band, where the distance between the least among us and the greatest among us widened. This was in 2002. And all of a sudden, we had people running through the middle of the Netherlands where the middle class had been raping and scraping everything they could, buying up companies, taking the profitable margins out of the companies, taking the physical plant equipment that they could sell off out of the companies, firing the employees, bankrupting the companies, and taking the goods to sale. Unemployment grew. Profit disappeared, except for those who had done the work. Like, I must admit, that was the established purpose of Bain Capital. They were specialists in it. That's what they intended. That's what they set out to do. That was their niche. They did it very well. Started a couple of new industries around, as a matter of fact. But it spread across multiple empires. But in the middle of this is the person who's about to retire, and the only thing that they can hold on to for their retirement, it's not their savings, it's not their pension, it's their Social Security. And all of a sudden, an artificial run on the tank, if you will, turned this will feed my grandchildren into who's going to feed me. And it happened within 6 years. Then we had this amazing moment when several artificially created bubbles burst all at the same time, all for the same reason this was just the next generation of greed, where we didn't even talk about profit to the bottom line anymore. We talked about if there's a billion to be made overnight, it's going to be mine and it's not going to be yours. And if I have to create false security in order to do that, I'll do that. Well, when President Clinton made it possible to create multi-use banking systems for both finance and collateralization for lending, then imaginative, innovative fund managers decided that they could do both. And all of a sudden we had the development of credit default swaps, where they were bundling less than sterling mortgage securities into financial packages that they were then selling at a profit, betting, mind you, the package would fail, that the credit would default. And if the credit did in fact default, these guys made a flat killing. That was your billion overnight. We had places like Countrywide, other mortgage lenders that were telling people you don't even have to qualify. Just come in, sign on the dotted line, you'll be a homeowner. Housing contracts were at the highest in the peak of American history. These guys were building houses so fast they couldn't finish them fast enough. And they were houses that, according to a growing housing market, were, say, 70, 80 times outside the economic possibility of the people who had just gotten a mortgage on them. In other words, these people were told, even though they themselves knew it, they could not make these mortgage payments, that they qualified for these houses. Lousy credit. Didn't matter. They were being bundled with AAA credit into suspect packages that they were then selling as financial products, making a killing. And the one thing that this nation had never seen in its whole entire life happened. And I wasn't the one to report it, Greg, but it did come out one day, one dark, dark day, that it seemed that the mortgage value of houses in the United States was somehow dropping. And within the space of 2 months, it had become a complete meltdown. Because it was tied to financial packages, the financial packages melted down too. And our country experienced a free-falling economy. People, 7.6 million people within 2 months lost their homes. They were now living in cars. Couldn't get an apartment because apartments are always, you know, off the rim. They couldn't get jobs because they had no security. They had no permanent address. You can't get a paycheck in America if you don't have a permanent address. All of a sudden, the homeless rate goes up. All of a sudden, the needs rate goes up. All of a sudden, the draw on the trust fund goes up. And the trust fund handled every call. Never one time defaulted. But took a hit.
If you get a chance, you might already know this story. I would suggest to you and your listeners to Google Magnetar and ProPublica. They did a wonderful investigative piece, I think it was maybe 2 years ago now, might be even a little longer, that even for a layperson like me explains exactly what you're talking about and how it came about, and even more to the point that individuals like the people who ran Magnetar knew full well that they were bundling really bad debt into collateralized securities and going out and selling it as if it was high-quality securities. They literally were lying in order to make millions and millions of dollars.
They're absolutely well true. And I think there's something, I don't know if Magnetar is the one that I'm thinking about. Are you talking about the Countrywide?
Well, Countrywide as a mortgage lender, and I've read a very interesting book by a former VP of marketing at Countrywide, a great expose, and I think it was called, it might be called something like The Bankrupting of America or something along those lines. Again, you know, do a Google search or check Amazon on books about Countrywide. But what Countrywide was doing was knowingly selling mortgages to people they knew didn't qualify because they knew precisely this, and that is that they were not going to hold those loans. That was the other big part of what allowed the bubble to create, was that if I'm going to loan you money and I know you can't pay it back, but I make a commission and I make origination fees and I make money selling you this loan that I will then sell to someone else, I've washed my hands of the risk. Why do I care if you can pay it back or not? If I have no scruples, no morals, and no ethics, I don't care.
I made my profit.
Yeah, exactly. So I sell you this mortgage. You now have a loan that you might be able to afford for the first 3 years, but when that adjusting of the rate occurs, the balloon starts to happen, you can't afford it anymore, but I don't care because I don't hold your debt. It's not mine. It's sold off somewhere else, bundled into these mortgage-backed securities, which you can now, because of an unregulated financial services industry, play the opposite end of the game, just like you were talking about. Collateralized debt obligations are that bet against that mortgage-backed security. And if I'm really unethical, I will do both. And I will sell you, based on a lie, the value of these bundled mortgages while I bet on their default, because I know it's going to happen.
Because it's a necessary win situation. I cannot lose. Matter of fact, the only thing that can happen is I could potentially win twice or more.
It's exactly right. It's exactly what was going on. And again, I encourage you and your listeners, Google Magnetar and ProPublica. This American Life, National Public Radio show, also did an hour-long show about this. So if you'd rather listen to it than read it, you will get to hear the report that I think it's Ira Glass, I think, is the guy who does This American Life. Wonderful, wonderful expose. And, Bud, I would love to keep talking to you, but I am being called to dinner. So I'm
going
to wish you a
great day. Well, it is necessary that you eat. I put a link to Magnetar and ProPublica into our chat link, and I thank you for your participation today, and I look forward to talking to you again.
It was my pleasure, Bud. I will talk to you again soon. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye-bye. Well, we didn't mean to go there, but I'm glad for the call. I'm glad that we had the interaction, and I hope that people can understand that there are some things that we really need to be addressed. I noticed one of the more common comments in today's chat was that it seems that the banksters and hedge fund managers have gone away. Well, they haven't. They're still here. And to know that the top 24 income earners in America receiving about 40% of the income generated in America last year were hedge fund managers. And you ask yourself the question, how is this possible? We talked last Sunday about the billionaires class and the billionaires club and the billionaire party. And this is their entrance into their ticket into that group. They may not last long enough because theirs is existentially new money, and new money doesn't ever mix well with old money. So the guys that have been doing it a long time see these new billionaires as nothing more than temporary flash in the pan upstarts. However, in the year that is most important, 2012, these 24 upstarts had 40% of American income going into their pocket. And that's a rather amazing statistic. We have some of the richest people in America doing all they can to destroy democracy in America, and that's how they're funding it. by ignoring the social contract, cheating on the debt, creating impossible situations, not for themselves, but for everybody else. They don't care who owns a mortgage. They just bundle it, sell it, and leave. It's not their problem anymore, just as our caller said. But what about the person who can't pay the bill? And we have 7.6 million people who actually did pay the bill, found themselves in a situation where they could never pay off their house because their payments were sometimes 100% more than the value of the house. And they said, there's a solution for that. And they walked away. Because it was an unfair proposition. The contract had been broken. And so far as I'm aware today, there's absolutely no criminal indictment or conviction for anybody who walked away from an upside-down mortgage during the mortgage meltdown. And yes, to my guest in the chat room who asked, where are the billionaire Dems? Just Gates and Buffett. Gates is not a Democrat. Warren Buffett is probably a Democrat, but identifies himself as being independent. The great name that comes up is George Soros, who has not been involved in politics in 27 years. There are plenty of billionaires out there who are Democrats. A lot of political grassroots organizations are sponsored by very rich Democrats who give seed money to causes like, the environment, education. Mr. Gates gives a lot of money to an education too, but it's not quite the same education. The Democrats tend to be in favor of public education. Mr. Gates Foundation tends to be very much engaged in private for-profit charter schools. And he gives his money to, among, others, he's a primary donor to the American Legislative Exchange Council. And believes that his profit can be magnified if we dispense with democratic principles. So you can Google the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and put that together with a Google for the American Legislative Exchange Council and see. At least last time I did, 128 different points of similar or overlap. Now, the Gates Foundation did refuse to fund the education panels for the American Legislative Exchange Councils, but their money is still going in through different sources. Another one to look at are the state policy networks. Each state has one. They're all outlying funds for Koch Industries, Koch Foundation, Heritage Foundation, ALEC, and other groups who are doing the same thing, by the way, meeting with corporate leaders who join up with state government leaders, senior members of committees, and senior members of leadership in both the House and Senates of each of the states, handing them proposed model legislation, which then they then take to their committees and without comment pass. Stand Your Ground Law was sponsored by Walmart and the NRA, first tested in Florida. When it passed in Florida, it was in 27 states within 30 days, and without so much as one citizen's comment. Walmart then became the world's largest retailer of long guns and ammunition in the world by legislation, and therein lies the problem. How can we deal with that? We've talked about some big issues here. We talked about things that seem to be so large that they're unmanageable. And what I want to do is I want to talk to you as you sit around your kitchen table, not your boardroom table, not your lunch table at work. I want to talk about under your kitchen table, under your roof. What are you going to do about this? If you're struggling because you can't find work, If you're struggling because you can't get health care, if you're struggling because you're a minority or a female, I have some good news for you. There is something you can do about it. You can make absolutely certain that you are both qualified and registered to vote in the 2014 election. I would like to tell you that I don't care how you vote, but of course I do. I don't want you voting against your own self-interest. I want you to understand the facts, the candidates, and understand that it is the Tea Party, the Republican Party, who is in a very serious situation right now because, I mean, opposed to how you may feel about them, the reality is it is a party in implosion mode. It's dying. And they killed themselves. And they're angry about that to the point where they don't matter what, they don't care what government does. They just care whether or not government does anything. They don't want government to do anything, and certainly not anything proposed by this president or his administration or his party. They're going to go down taking as many as they can with them, which is why 24 states say, no, we will not accept free money in the billions of dollars for 3 years, and then you pay us 90% of all our costs and claims for the next seven. No, we're not going to do that. Why? Because we don't like you. That's why. We don't like the regulations that you put in place that require us to do things right. That's why we don't like the EPA. And the people of West Virginia look at that and say, well, of course you don't. What are you going to do about this, like, you know, water that feeds 350,000 of our citizens that no longer can trust the water they drink? Nothing. That's on you. All we want to do is, it's illegal to dump stuff into the river, okay? Now, I learned this just this week. I want you to follow me closely because it's going to grind your mind. I trust my listeners. I want you to understand this. This is the situation. Let's talk about Charleston, West Virginia, just as an example. Strange chemicals go into the water and into the ground, and at times they're noticed, and all of a sudden you've got useless soil and you've got a useless facility and you've got a useless water supply. The very first thing that happens is the company that's responsible for this water being polluted declares bankruptcy. Very first thing. You have to follow the path up the corporate ladder to find out who's actually pulling the strings of the executives of this company. If you do, you will be shocked. I'll leave that for you to do. The answer that those who are pulling the strings have for this situation in Charleston, West Virginia is the problem is the regulation. We need to remove the regulation by eliminating the EPA. The only reason dumping our stuff into your water is illegal is because of the unnecessary and burdensome regulations for safety and organizational management imposed upon us by the EPA. If we remove the EPA, we remove the regulations, it's no longer illegal and we don't have to care. Yes, that's a paraphrase. But it's a paraphrase that is very, very close to being a direct word-for-word quote. If we simply remove the regulations, then it's not illegal anymore. I heard that in three separate conditions of reality situations going on in America today. To the people who have to worry about whether or not their drinking water catches fire or whether it has cancer-causing agents in it, that's not really good news. Somebody's going to have to clean that stuff up. Mother Nature can't do it by herself. In the meantime, you got 350,000 people without safe water. What are you going to do about that? Well, if you are on the conservative Republican side, you say just disavow the EPA, remove the regulations, then it's not illegal anymore. And we don't have to care. If you're on the Democratic liberal conservative or liberal progressive side, you'll say that answer seems to be unacceptable. We need to do better than that. What you can do at your kitchen table is you can make absolutely certain that you are both registered and qualified to vote. It takes both of them. You can also write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper stating your specific case, your specific concern. You can write those who represent you at your city council, your county commission, your state district for House and Senate, and your federal legislative members as well. You can share what you've written with a neighbor and ask them to write the same thing if it matters to them. Write their story. It doesn't take a template. It just takes a little time. We've got people who are having house parties where they're writing letters to the editor on one subject. And we've got members who are creating house parties where they live in order to do the same thing. And I will give you a link to that, where you can actually look for a group near you who are doing the very things that we're talking about. They're talking to their representatives about their disenchantment with government, with the idea that oligarchs are attempting to maintain control of this country, that the interest of corporate influence is much more worthy and much more important and significant to the things of America, that a few should rule and everybody else should be subservient to them. There are things going on right now all across the country. We are not alone. You are not alone. It's happening. It's happening in amazing states. It's happening in amazing places. It's happening because of amazing people who take their democracy seriously, who understand that if we do not remove these dangerous people from our collective legislative bodies, that we're going to live a day where democracy no longer exists in the United States in my lifetime. It's not because we disagree. It's because the goal's different. I have no desire to eliminate any department of the federal government because I think we've been rather sparse about creating them. I think we've been rather stingy in our creating funds for them to do the jobs we then established for them to do. If that had been the case in BLM's case, we wouldn't have had Clive and Bundy in jail. He'd be under a jail. Everything he owns would be belonging to the federal government for auction right now, including his cattle. This man for 20 years has touted the law, the federal law of the United States of America, and dared anybody to do anything. I know that ranchers have a hard way. I know that there's a lot of hard stuff that goes into ranching, but you don't do what he did. I'll tell you. You need to watch this week because that situation is nowhere near over. And you need to be very concerned about it because these people are directly flaunting their unwillingness to be citizens of the United States. I think that's a very bad thing. The question remains, what are you going to do about it? I've given you a list of three things that you can do about it today. One you can do tomorrow. Make sure that you're both registered and qualified to vote in the precinct where you live. Talk to your neighbors. Join a group that's coming together to write letters to the editor or to a political party or to a representative and talk about the things that matter to you personally. And if you find one that you're passionate about, find a group of people who are getting together to talk about it. Or if you're really, really honestly bold and you're so angry you don't want to put up with it anymore, start one of your own by going to either of the places that I put in the chat room. You can do that. I want you to understand that this show is empowering It's empowering you to make a difference where you live. You can become the change you seek, but you have to do it. Now, President Obama never said, yes, I can, or yes, I will. What he said was, yes, we can. We is you and me. So how about we spend just a little bit of time honoring that position, regardless of our political party, our political ideology? Do it civilly, and do it where it matters most, within 12 blocks of where you live. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia for the past 2 hours, I have been the Tennessee Progressive. I hope you'll do something about it today. Good luck. Happy Easter. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Passover. Go out and make a difference today right where you live. Do it as a citizen would. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.
My eyes have seen the glory.